يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East North Africa region. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. And before we kick off properly, I'm going to have to do this. Yes, silence in court, please. There's a very definite reason for doing this, because we're about to get very legal with you, or maybe slightly legal. And if you're going to get legal, you need a good brief. That's the bottom line. And I have one. Sitting opposite me is the wonderful Dr. Harry Hagopian, who is, amongst other things, an international lawyer. Harry, how are you?
Hello, James. It's the first time, actually, you've introduced me first as a lawyer and then as a MENA consultant, etc., etc. So I'm delighted to be here and to listen to the judge's gavel banging. Maybe you can keep me in order and make sure that I do not go on and on.
Keep you in order? Fat chance. But I'll try. I'll try as a service to our listeners. Harry, there's so much to talk about, isn't there always? So we are really going to do a bit of a whistle stop today, if that's okay with you,
that's
going around the MENA region.
I mean, we are meeting up every so many weeks, so we can't really go into in-depth analyses, which would take a long time. So a whistle-stop tour today would be absolutely lovely, because you are right, the MENA region is rife with so many stories.
Now, who knows what our listeners will think of the running order, but please forgive me if you think I haven't prioritised accordingly. But I want to start with the poisoning of the former president of the Palestinian Authority, the chair of the Palestinian Liberation Organisation, Yasser Arafat.
Uh-huh.
Was he poisoned? You know, if so or if not, the implications 9 years after his death, Harry, what are they?
Let me put on my lawyer's wig and then answer. Now, our viewers can't see this because today we're not doing a Vimeo, we're doing an audio podcast. Mm-hmm. So imagine Harry sitting here with the judge in front of him being James, asking me those questions.
Get on
Yasser
with it.
Yasser Arafat, yes, absolutely. I like a stern judge. Yasser Arafat, 9 years ago, died in November 2004 in France. Even since then, 9 years ago, there was a lot of talk. If you ask any Palestinian, in fact, if you ask many of the Arab citizens of the wide Middle East North Africa region, they would tell you that was not a natural death, or that was not just any illness. He definitely was poisoned. The reason being is because he was pretty much confined for the last few months of his life in Ramallah, where his headquarters were based in the West Bank, north of Jerusalem. He was sequestered basically in his headquarters, and he couldn't go out because the Israeli tanks surrounded the building, and he had become pretty much a political persona non grata, and everybody was saying, you know what, he is the biggest impediment to the solution or the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Get Yasser Arafat out of the equation, and you know what, we will have a solution for this long festering conflict. And then, hey ho, a few months later, the man died. Now, since then, his wife, his widow now, Suha, and their daughter Zahwa, as well as many Palestinians and Arabs, have said that no, this is poisoning. There's something happened, and we're not sure what it is. So a year ago, Al Jazeera satellite TV actually started an investigation on whether he was indeed poisoned or not. And to cut a long story short, before you start banging the gavel again, there were samples taken. The body was exhumed. There were samples taken to see whether there were any traces of any radioactive elements within the body, even 9 years past his death, to see whether, in fact, he was poisoned. And three different countries actually took it upon themselves to check this: France, Switzerland, and Russia. Russia and Switzerland, on the behest of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, and France, because Arafat's widow, Suha, and their daughter are French nationals. The court case was actionable. The investigation was actionable from her end. Now, the reason why we're talking about this is that the Swiss and Russian results have come back. So there is a big thing in the media these couple of days. The French one, mysteriously enough, has not yet appeared. So we don't know what that report would say, to the best of my knowledge. But the Swiss one is saying that there is an 80% chance that this was death by radioactive polonium-210, so it was poisoning by a radioactive element. The Russian one fudges the issue. On the one hand, says it might have been a radioactive poisoning. On the other hand, it says we're not sure if it was. It's almost as if Russia is trying to please the Palestinians by giving them something and not anger the Israelis by not pointing the finger. So my four questions now, with my lawyer's wig on, are the following. And I leave it as open questions to our listeners because we don't really have clear-cut answers yet. One, was it indeed a crime, and a crime by radioactive poisoning? In other words, was Arafat killed on purpose to get him out of the way? Not that it did much to the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue, mind you. Second, if it was a crime, who is the perpetrator of that crime? Three, even if, as the Palestinians and many others lay the blame on Israel, who aided and abetted? I mean, to poison somebody, you have to get the polonium into that body. Who did it? There weren't any Israelis sitting in the room with Arafat. So are there any Palestinians who might have aided and abetted the process? And fourth, if this becomes clearer, particularly once the French report also comes out, what are the legal recourses that are available? There is one that immediately jumps out at me legally, but I think that politically it's very difficult. But those are the four questions I would actually ask myself, you and the listeners.
I suppose I'm not going to sound like a judge. I'm probably going to sound more like a barrister, but I'm going to put it to you, Dr. Hagopian,
yes,
that this doesn't make any difference to the peace process.
This doesn't make any difference to the peace process at all. It only makes the difference to the peace process in the sense that you remember the General Assembly accepted Palestine as a member state, observer member state. Now, that means that the Palestine today can actually ratify certain agreements, one of them being the Statute of Rome, and become a member of the International Criminal Court. If it does become a member of the ICC, then it can actually refer this case to the ICC for further investigation, and then the ICC would be beholden to investigating and knowing the truth behind this story. Now, the reason I'm tying this into the question you said is because legally it is possible for Palestine, between inverted commas, to go to the ICC, but politically, given that there are ongoing negotiations now between Israel and the Palestinians on trying to find a solution, and these negotiations are pushed very, very strongly by Secretary of State John Kerry, it would basically spoil those negotiations because Israel would not accept it. So the question is, does Palestine and the Palestinians go the legal way if it becomes even more certain that something funny had happened to Arafat, or would they decide to hold off for a while because it would completely sabotage whatever discussions are happening between those two parties?
Okay, we are now moving to an Egyptian courtroom.
Did you bang the gavel?
I will now. As I say, come with me, Harry, come with me. We're going to an Egyptian courtroom now.
Okay.
This is an Egyptian court, figuratively speaking, of
yes.
course. Now, former President Mohamed Morsi, and it's important to use the former there, has been on trial, now deferred. I find this fascinating and confusing, and I need your help with it, says the judge, or probably wouldn't ever say that, but there we go. Tell us a little
bit. What the judge would say, incidentally, James, is he would ask the lawyers, the barristers, to clarify a point. So you're asking for clarification.
I feel you're trying to take over the judge's role here, but Dear me, we're playing this theme, aren't we? Yes, please, clarify and significance of the aforementioned.
I'll do that. Our listeners will have seen, I'm sure, or at least some of them will have, the trial of that of ex-president Morsi of Egypt, which started a few days ago. It was a very brief trial. It was the first appearance in court, and it was very brief because it was automatically deferred till the 8th of January. Now, our listeners might say, fine, he was ousted, he was deposed. There was a huge argument, there still is, about whether this was a coup d'etat or whether this was a legitimate ouster or deposal of a president. You and I discussed this in one of our podcasts, but they would say, okay, that's one thing, but what is he actually being tried for? And actually what he's being tried for is he's being charged with incitement to murder and torture. Now, incitement to what murder and torture? It's incitement to murder and torture that took place on the 5th and 6th of December 2012, when, remember, he was still president, and there were confrontations between Muslim Brotherhood supporters and other protesters from the secular and Christian and other Muslim factions, and 10 people at least were killed. And so the state now is saying that we're going to try ex-president Morsi because his statements actually incited for the murder and torture of those people during this two-day period. Now, it's very interesting because unlike the trial of the former president Mubarak, where he came to the cage and he was on a bed because he was supposed to be too sick to sit down straight on a chair or stand up, but he was wearing the white garb, the white uniform that prisoners wear where they're in that cage. And it's a cage that goes from the floor all the way to the ceiling, James, if you saw the pictures. Morsi refused. He came in his blue suit, the presidential suit as it's become known in Egypt, and he defied, whereas Mubarak accepted the authority of the court and said, answered the questions. Morsi refused to answer the question. He said, I do not accept the jurisdiction and the authority of this court. And it's very interesting because one of the Islamist lawyers, I would probably not see eye to eye very much with him on a lot of things, but an Islamist lawyer in Egypt called Muhammad Salim Al-Awwa, he actually invoked the 2012 constitution in Egypt, which was passed during Morsi's one-year term as president. And that 2012 constitution, what is it? It's basically the basic law, in which he used Article 152 of that constitution. Now, we don't even know if that constitution is valid or not, but it's going to change anyway. And he basically referred to that as the article which deals with the impeachment of a president. And he cast doubt on the jurisdiction and authority of the court to try a president whom the Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt still very much consider the legitimate president of Egypt. And anything that has happened since last June, so we're talking 5-6 months now, is pretty much irrelevant in their minds. And they're thinking that what is happening with Morsi is just the state, in collusion with the judiciary, are scapegoating the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi in order to get rid of them and start a new page where the military will come in as strong, and I'm worried about this, by the way, James, as strong as they were pre the ouster and deposal of the former president Hosni Mubarak. And they claim that the state institutions are implicated in this witch hunt or scapegoating. There is unease in many quarters within Egypt, but more so outside Egypt, that the military is getting its, what's the expression in English, James? This is where I betray my non-English basic roots. You get your feet under the table or your toe in the door something.
That's fine, trying to get your feet under the table. Yeah.
There you go. That the military is trying once again to take control of Egypt. And if they do that, I can't see what the difference would be with what had happened before Mubarak was overthrown. So I'm hoping that that will not happen with the military, but I'm also observing as a lawyer, since I've got the wig and you've got the gavel, I'm observing as a lawyer what would happen with Morsi's trial, because concurrently with that, there might well be a continuation of the trial of Hosni Mubarak. And imagine two former presidents in a cage, one in white uniform, another in a blue suit, and both of them claiming that they're still valid presidents of the country.
I have to do this again because I have my gavel. And what that means, Harry, is that court is adjourned for the time being.
Okay.
We're moving on now to Iran. Now, we don't often talk about Iran, actually. But in this case, I want to talk about the enrichment of uranium.
Yes.
Iran's nuclear program, whether it's weapons grade or not.
Absolutely.
Enrichment towards weapons grade, but obviously the regime says that's not the purpose for their enrichment of uranium. Now, tell me a little bit about how we're heading towards a draft agreement on maybe relieving the sanctions somewhat, the international community, if Iran slows down its enrichment.
Well, it's interesting, James, because let me just go back 2 minutes to put a context to this, to my answer for our listeners. This whole love fest, if I were to call it that, and I'm calling it that very, very sparingly, between America and Iran, or what I call the P5 plus one, in other words, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany, who are negotiating with Iran on its nuclear file, this love fest, as it were, happened during the time. It is one of the unintended consequences of the shall we attack Syria or shall we not attack Syria that the Americans had for a while after the Syrian regime used chemical weapons against some of the rebels. And we all know that's pretty much history now, given how fast things move in the Middle East, North Africa. There was no attack. But as an unintended consequence of that, Obama from the American side and the new president of Iran, Rouhani, started basically expressing an interest to make the relations a bit less frosty, if not a bit warmer. And one of the consequences of that is that we now have hope that there will be some sort of a deal struck this week in terms of a first step toward relieving some of the very stringent sanctions that the West had imposed on Iran because of the nuclear file versus Iran downgrading its enrichment of uranium to a weaponized grade. Now, the interesting thing about it is not only the technical side. I cannot talk to you about the technical side. It's way above my pay scale. But what I could say is that politically, since now we're politicians and not lawyers, politically, what that means is that America and Iran are desperately trying to find an accommodation whereby America would no longer feel that it has to take any military or robust action against Iran, but whereas on the other side, Iran's economy, which is really staggering, would actually be relieved of some of those sanctions. It's almost like the carrot with the stick behind it saying, okay, we'll relieve you of some of sanctions. If you do what you promised to do, we'll go another step, and it will be a series of steps that will probably be consolidated in an agreement if all goes well, and you never know in that part of the world, where it will be consolidated by an agreement where it will be clear that Iran will not try to have the bomb, as it were. But funnily enough, I will take that a little bit further then, and I would say that this has caused an unholy row between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the U.S. administration, particularly Secretary of State John Kerry, who only this week met three times with the Israeli Prime Minister, the last time being in the VIP lounge at Ben Gurion Airport, to try and convince the Israelis that the Americans are not selling out. The Israelis aren't convinced. They think this is a very bad deal. Of course they would think so, partly because they're worried about some of the statements that the former Iranian president Ahmadinejad made questioning the Jewish Holocaust, questioning Israel's existence, but also because there is a lot of paranoia and a lot of politicking that happens within Israel, given what a hard line cabinet it is with members and ministers there that are extremely non-negotiating, to use a euphemism. Mm-hmm. But My own take on this, Netanyahu is not going to be converted overnight and say, fine, this is an okay deal and I'll give my blessing. What will happen is that I would like to see if this first step were taken, would Congress agree to it, or would they give the Americans a hard time? Because Congress is pretty much more pro-Israel than the administration in some sense, I suppose, and I'm speaking a little bit broadly here. But also, what I would advise Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he certainly doesn't ask my advice, is that if you're really so worried about Iran, then try to strike a deal with the Palestinians. Give them something. Don't degrade their situation so much that they cannot continue with the negotiations. Because if you have Iran as your main anathema, your main bogey, your main concern, the best you can do is to relieve yourself of the Israeli-Palestinian situation and in the process acquire a few kudos diplomatically and internationally, something which neither him nor the Israeli government are able or willing to date to do, hence the mess we are in on that level.
Let's now move on to something, well, it does have a holier side, but it has a very concerning side. We could have opened up this programme, actually, with Syria and the state of play in Syria, particularly with the internally displaced up at around the 9 million.
Absolutely, 9.3 million, according to UNHCR figures.
Staggering, absolutely staggering.
And these are the internally displaced, James, yeah, plus the refugees outside the country, which are well over 2 million.
Important distinction. So 11.5 million plus.
Absolutely. You know what that means?
That's the
that
scale.
That means almost half the population of Syria, which is 22 million.
Unbelievable. But sadly believable.
Yep.
Now, two things I'm going to bring up with you. First of all, and perhaps you could footnote your piece on Syria with this, the Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches have released a statement about Syria.
Absolutely. I work with the Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches and its president, Bishop Vahan Hovhannisyan. And as our listeners can see, Jan Hovhannisyan, Jan Hagopian, we're both Armenian. And yes, there was a statement on Syria that was issued just 3-4 days ago.
Concerned for the peoples, for the Christians, of course. Tell us a little bit about that when you bring in your response. Also, I hear about a polio outbreak, which, you know, with the figures we've brought up and the conditions we've talked about, and we've frequently talked about the displaced as well, very alarming. And Geneva too, which some might say, yeah, well, you know, coming together to negotiate a solution on this was never going to be easy or even possible. So bring the whole Syria update to us.
Wow, James. Three points, three quick answers I'll try. First one, the Cook Statement, Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches, which consists of all the Oriental Orthodox Churches in the United Kingdom. We're talking about local, we're not talking international, and that means the Armenians, the Copts, the Syrians, the Ethiopians, the Indian Malabars, all of them came together and issued this statement, which basically once more, and it uses the word in the draft, once more, and I know that because I was involved in the drafting, once more express regret and concern about what is happening in Syria in general. It talks about what is happening, the tragedy that Syria has become for all its communities. Remember, majority are Sunni, but there are so many other smaller communities other than the Christians, incidentally, James. You have the Kurds, you have the Druze, you have the Alawites, etc., etc. So it expresses that. It also expresses concern about the Christian communities, because everybody, and we did another little item on a podcast about Malula, where, if you remember, I said it is the Lourdes of the Middle East, where everybody talks, oh my God, what's happened to the Christian communities in Malula? Well, there are other examples where Christians have actually had to face a lot of, well, persecution is one way of putting it, by those radicalized over-Islamist factions that are operating freely in Syria and not under the official imprimatur of the Free Syrian Army. So it talks about this. It refers to the two abducted bishops, the Syrian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox bishops, and basically it hopes that sense will prevail in Syria. But interestingly enough about this statement is that hopefully our own Archbishop Vincent Nichols of the Catholic Church might well endorse this statement, and therefore it becomes a Catholic Oriental Orthodox statement on the situation in Syria. I'll move on very quickly to the polio situation. Of course, a country where hospitals are not running properly, where there is no medication, where the sewage and the water are getting mixed up together, where there are no medics and doctors or dispensaries, where half the country... You know what? One of the worst things that we haven't touched upon is what the regime is now using. Until now, it was just pounding rebel-held areas with its aircraft and its bombs. Now, it is basically starving them to death by basically surrounding them, not leaving any, letting anybody come out or go in. And of course, at the end of the day, you run out of food, you run out of water, you run out of medication. What happens? Muazzamiyye is a good example of that for some of our more informed listeners. That happened last week, where, and there are many other areas where people are being starved to death. And there is actually a very nice picture on Twitter at the moment of a silver spoon with two handles at the bottom. And if you look at that spoon, it looks like a rifle or a gun. And that's basically the starvation policy that's being applied against some communities across Syria. So polio is there. And our own David Miliband, who used to be the former foreign secretary of this country under a Labour government and is now the CEO of the International Rescue in the New York, was in London, and he was talking so loud and sometimes desperately about the apocalyptic, his words, not mine, the apocalyptic repercussions of leaving Syria where it is, because it's sliding back not only in anarchy but in an irredeemable state of ill health. So yes, polio is one of the reasons why this is happening. Why? Because people are not being vaccinated. Why aren't they receiving their vaccines? Because there is no sense or order, no rhyme or reason in that country anymore. So sad, so sad. It makes me very sad.
Now, I think in a
Geneva too, you said.
Wow, Geneva too.
Well, all I'll say about Geneva too is that the opposition forces are so divided amongst themselves that they can't agree whether to attend Geneva II or not. And the regime is insisting that it will not go there if the expectation is for President Bashar al-Assad to hand over power to the opposition. So both sides are not happy with Geneva II yet. Both sides are supported by their own friends. And the so-called UN mediator, Lakhdar Ebrahimi, is basically shuttling from country to country, collecting mileage points, but not really producing much results yet.
I think what's tragic, having listened to your analysis there, is that, you know, it's clear, isn't it, that just because we can't always see blood doesn't mean that people aren't dying.
No, you can have bloodless deaths which are more cruel and more painful than bloody ones, because bloody ones mean you actually die on the spot. Bloodless deaths, it's strung out, and this is something that is very painful, and this is what is happening to the Syrian people. It's affecting neighbors, Lebanon, Jordan, with the refugees, and the world community whimpers, protests, expresses solidarity, but at the end of the day, I think, has left Syria pretty much to its own devices.
Now, what I'd like to do in a future podcast when it comes to Syria, because I think it's really quite important, I don't know if we've talked about that enough. We've talked about Turkey. We've talked about Lebanon. You just mentioned the neighbours and the impact. And those people that you know, 2 million plus that are, you know, trying to survive outside their home country.
Yeah.
There are also countries like Sweden and other countries a bit closer to home that are taking a lot of Syrian refugees.
Even Germany.
And Germany, of course. And
I would qualify, I'd like to open that a up lot, with you. James. I'm happy to open that up with you because I've got views on that, political and legal, by the way, so I'll bring my wig with me. But on that one, when we say a lot, remember there are over 2 million refugees, 1 million plus in Lebanon, almost that much in Jordan, two very small countries with very ailing economies. And we in the West, we do a lot of hoo-ha about how we are helping. We are, I'll give you an example. Let me prolong this podcast. Never mind. Forgive me, listeners. We talk about we cannot go the military path. fine, we cannot go the military path. While there are 2 million plus refugees in adjoining neighboring countries to Syria, where those countries, Lebanon, Jordan, even Iraq and others, are trying to carry the burden, we in the West make big headlines when we accept 2,000 of them. 2,000 out of 2 million plus, and we think we're doing something. This is not us using the military option. This is us helping on a humanitarian level. Or are we trying to open humanitarian doors or access to all those people who need to be vaccinated? We just talked about polio. I'll give you another example, which is closer to our own homes here, James. Syrian students who are doing PhDs and postgraduate studies in the universities in the UK and who came here based on scholarships by Syrian institutions are running out of money because those institutions aren't sending them any money at all. So they can't pay for their expenses. They can't pay for their tuition fees. These were people who came here to study in order to educate the Syrian people to another level of human international relations. They are actually being forced either to beg for money or to opt out of their universities or to have to go back to Syria, which they don't want to do. Can't we, the UK government, who have been so much at the avant-garde of trying to help the Syrian people, can't we say, look, we're going to keep you in your universities and we'll cover your expenses for the while? That, for me, does not need aircraft or any militarized option. It needs the human stroke humanitarian option.
And what it doesn't need is a House of Commons vote, which, of course,
All it needs is the secretary, Home Secretary, to agree to do it and the Prime Minister to give his nod.
Exactly. You see, that's where I wanted to go with the Future podcast, talk about the sort of scale of the Western European response,
and that's
as you
what,
pointed
incidentally,
out.
I'm getting a bit het up, James, as you can see, well, because you're smiling, because it affects me. All this affects me. We've been talking the MENA region for 3 years. It's a region that I consider my own. I'm part of that region. The genes of my forebears come from Turkey and then onto the Middle East, North Africa. I see the dissolution of this region. And whilst I'm not an intellectual and I do not pontificate about theories of what should happen or what should not happen, I feel for the ordinary people, from the most radical, because there is a reason why they're radical and even crazy, dare I use the term, to the least crazy and least radical of them. They are all suffering. And what are we doing? What are the churches doing? That's a question I ask. The World Council of Churches is meeting in Busan in South Korea. The patriarchs of the East are meeting. Everybody is making statements. We just talked about a statement of the Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches. What are we doing in terms of something as simple as the university students in this country, something as simple as the refugees, which David Miliband was talking about? This is where I say we have decided somehow to turn our backs to the region because we no longer understand it. I understand that we don't understand it, but that is not a reason for forsaking the region.
We've done a good half hour, Harry, a little bit more, actually. So it's summing up time. So we're almost back in the courtroom. Summing up time. You did want to say something about the World Council of Churches. You just mentioned that they're meeting in Korea, but weren't you going to talk to us a little bit about the new presidents that they have?
Yeah, I'll do that, but are you going to bang the gavel again?
Would you want to get back in courtroom mode?
No, ecumenism and courtroom mode don't work. You're absolutely right. They don't go together well.
The gavel is retired.
Like Frank Sinatra used to say, horse and carriage, ecumenism and lore. I'm not too sure. All I want to say, because you're right, half an hour, and listeners, forgive us, but this was a long podcast. We hadn't done one for weeks. The only thing I would say, and Ecclesia, the progressive think tank in the UK, actually published kindly a piece, a commentary I did on the World Council of Churches meeting in Busan in South Korea. The World Council of Churches consists of all the Orthodox churches, the Anglican Church, and all the Reformed churches. The Catholic churches are not members of this ecumenical worldwide body, but they are observers. And to be honest with you, nothing happens without their okay. So in a sense, we are there as Catholics, if I I put for a minute the Catholic hat on now, but we're there in an observer capacity. However, this assembly is the 10th assembly. It happens every 5 to 7 years. And one of the tasks of the assembly is to elect new presidents representing pretty much different families of churches across the whole world. And the commentary I did on Ecclesia website was I highlighted two presidents who mattered to me, the new elected. One is His Holiness Catholicos Karikin II, who is the, let me put it this way, the Pope of the Armenian Orthodox Church worldwide. He was one of the two who was there. And I was quite happy he's there because the Armenian Church is remarkably ecumenical. It's ethnocentric in so many different ways, which I disapprove of, but it's very ecumenical when it comes to other churches. So I'm delighted he's there. It will have its consequences upon dialogue, not only with the Anglican and Reformed churches, but it will strengthen the very solid relations that the Armenian Orthodox Church has with the Catholic Church. The number of times that Armenian popes have visited Rome and met with popes, starting with Paul VI, all the way to John Paul II, to Benedict and to Francis, is a legacy of relations between the two churches. So I'm happy with that. Besides, he's Armenian, James. And the other thing is very significant. Patriarch John the 10th, or Yohanna al-Ashir, who is basically the patriarch of the Antiochian Greek Orthodox, in other words, the Arab-speaking Eastern Orthodox of Syria and Lebanon. He was also elected. Very significant, because we've been doing nothing but talking of his neck of the woods. And as patriarch president of the World Council of Churches, he might bring some input into the World Council of Churches of the realities in that part of the region, not only upon Christians, please know, upon the whole citizens of all that region. But interestingly enough for you and your listeners is that he also is the brother of one of the two abducted bishops in northern Syria near Aleppo that we have often talked about and that the Cook statement we just discussed briefly also refers to. Wow, that was quite a long paragraph, James.
It really was. And in a sense, I wish I'd picked the gavel up again. I've not been a very good judge. I've just allowed for this very long podcast.
You've been a very good judge. You know, you remind me of whom? You remind me of my favorite judge of all times. When I was doing my law studies in this country, incidentally, my favorite judge, and now listeners could then place me in a time space, was Lord Denning, Master of the Rolls. Mm-hmm. Lord Denning was a fantastic judge, he of the High Trees judgment and other judgments, because he was firm but malleable. And that is what you were. You had the gavel, you banged it a few times, but you never actually told me, listen, you've spoken too much. Shut up now. So I thank you for that. And I thank the listeners for their patience too.
Hear, hear. I thank them too. And I thank you, Harry, Dr. Harry Hagopian.
Thank you, James.
At Harry Hagopian on Twitter. You mentioned Twitter
at
least
once.
Oh, yes,
my counterintuitive, countercultural dabbling with Twitter.
Yeah, check it out, listeners. It's different, would be my way of putting it. Our own account at Catholic EW. Please do follow us if you're not doing so already. Catholicnews.org.uk is the home of Middle East analysis. And I've got to give a quick nod to your website, Harry, epectarsis.net.
And thanks to you, James, we don't say this often enough, not for the interviews. People only listen to us talking. It's a little bit like Strictly Come Dancing, where the people view the dancers. They forget that there are so many people working behind the scenes to prepare those dancers. We talk and people say, oh, James and Harry are having a banter and hopefully a proper analysis of the MENA region. But I know how much time you then have to spend to edit those podcasts or Vimeos in order for them to go out on air. So thank you for that as well.
No, not at all. Well, as you say, we'll try and keep the gap between our Middle East analysis podcast down for the future. So
I speak less.
No, I'm not at all. But I'll be wheeling you back in with permission in the next couple of weeks.
Okie doke.
Thanks, Harry.
Pleasure.